I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. As we go into the fall election season, quite apart from the excitement at the top of the ticket, ballot questions, as referendums are called in Maryland, are probably the most important votes to cast. In Montgomery County, the former Republican County Executive candidate, Reardon Sullivan, has led a petition to reduce the term limit length for the county executive from 3 to 2 terms. We have an episode on that. The Montgomery County Council has written a letter to the state leadership asking that the 10,000 signature threshold for petitions be raised to a percentage of registered voters. In Baltimore, a petition led by a progressive group to get the city to pay $1,000 to new parents, called the baby bonus, has been opposed by the mayor and the city council. And they have gone to court to keep the question off the ballot. There are other petitions seeking to cap property taxes and to reduce the size of the city council, backed by billionaire David Smith, the owner of the Baltimore Sun. In one-party dominant states where the electoral prospects of weaker party candidates are meager, ballot questions are a form of opposition action. They are also a way for citizen groups and third-party activists to seek political change. One person who has thought greatly about the politics of ballot questions is Baltimore resident and Green Party activist Andy Ellis. Ellis has served on the Charter Commission for his city and just submitted signatures to the Maryland State Board of Elections supporting petitions to put the Green Party back on the ballot in Maryland, including Jill Stein, the Green Party's national standard bearer for this November, and himself as a gubernatorial candidate in 2026. The State Board has 2 weeks or so remaining to validate the signatures. Whatever you think of third-party politics, Andy Ellis follows the ballot question issues more closely than almost anyone I know. You will want to hear him out.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving, precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Alexandria, Virginia, art rock band Jackie and the Treehorns. Steven Rubin and Pam Long on vocals, guitars, and piano. Frank Caputo on the bass and synth. And Brian Gibson on the drums. Andy Ellis, welcome back to I Hate Politics.
Thank you, Sunil. I'm excited to be here.
The Montgomery County Council has recently written to the state leadership, particularly Senate President Bill Ferguson and House Speaker Adrian Jones, asking that there be a constitutional amendment that raises the threshold for the number of signatures required to get a petition on the ballot, a question on the ballot. You've been following this issue for some time now. What are they really asking for?
I think they're really asking to make it harder for people to be able to get petitions like the one that is going to set term limits on the county executive. I think they're trying to make it harder for citizen-led groups to use a petition in order to get on the ballot. I don't think it is. I don't think it is coincidental that this came right after a petition was filed and certified by the Montgomery County Board of Elections, which will allow there to be term limits on the county executive.
Now, similar things are happening in Baltimore as well.
Baltimore City has a large number of citizen-based charter amendments this year. There is one that comes from a group called Peace, which is funded entirely by David Smith of Sinclair Broadcasting, which is trying to reduce the size of the council from 14 to 8. There is another one by a group called Renew Baltimore, which is trying to reduce the property tax rate in Baltimore City. There's another one from the Baltimore Baby Bonus, which seeks to give a direct cash payment to new parents. And there's another one from the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition, which seeks to do a regional transit authority, which would be funded by the city.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of this politics, why do we have so many ballot questions?
So I was part of the Baltimore City Charter Commission, and one of the things that we looked into was the nature of ballot questions in the state of Maryland since 1999. And for most charter counties, there's two different ways that a charter amendment can get onto the ballot. One is the council passes something that amends the charter, and that goes to the voters. The other is that citizens can collect a petition with signatures of registered voters and turn that in order to get something on the ballot. The vast majority of charter amendments that have happened in Maryland have been the first route. The council is putting something that they want to change onto the ballot. But there's a lot of attention on the citizen-driven ones because oftentimes they are more foundational, more disruptive, and more significant changes to the form and nature of government. And so I think in the last couple of years, especially in Baltimore City, there has been an increased focus on these popular petition-driven ones. And I think it's starting to scare people when they see folks like David Smith, who is the owner of Sinclair Broadcasting and the owner of the Baltimore Sun, trying to backdoor the legislative process.
What is the difference in the nature of petitions that come from the council versus the petitions that are more grassroots or seemingly more grassroots that are driven by signatures?
The charter amendments that come from the council are smaller tweaks. Baltimore City has a charter amendment in 2020 that established a charter commission, for example, and made it permanent. Baltimore City often has things that say the mayor will have authority to have a city administrator or something like that. More inside baseball tweaks that the government feels that it needs to do in order to be able to effectively carry out its vision. Whereas the citizen-driven ones are often bigger things like reduce the size of the council or, term limit the executive.
It turns out that most ballot questions are actually approved in Maryland, which is what really is the issue. If, the voters were rejecting ballot questions equally, then, that'd be some level of discernment.
There's big differences between Montgomery County and Baltimore City, for example. So Baltimore City has passed 49 of the 50 ballot initiatives that have been in front of its voters since 1999, whereas Montgomery County has rejected 25% of the ballot initiatives that have been in front of it since 1999. The political culture of a municipality helps to shape how you react to these things. I think in Baltimore City, it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to pass. So nobody usually feels like spending the time, political capital, or energy to try to defeat them. I think that's changing this year, but I think that's part of what has happened in the past.
Do you understand why that is the case?
In Baltimore City, our charter is 280 some odd pages. And so there are a lot of small changes that occur to our charter that seem meaningless to most voters. So oftentimes on our ballot, we'll have questions like A through K or something. And I think many times voters are like, okay, all of these seem meaningless to me. Fine, vote yes. So I think that's part of it, is that the number of questions on the ballot increase the likelihood that voters are going to fall off or drop off by the time they get to the bottom. And they're not making distinctions on 9 different questions.
Given the number of questions that are there, is it your understanding that people either vote yes or abstain, that there are far fewer no votes?
There are no votes in Baltimore City on things that have attention drawn to them. So in 2022, Question K, which was sponsored by David Smith and Sinclair, put term limits on the council. The council did fight against it a little bit, and there were a decent amount of votes that were no against it. It had more combined yes and no votes than any of the other charter amendments. And so I think if there is attention drawn to it, there's more likely to be contested votes on it. I think oftentimes when there's not attention drawn to it, especially when it feels like the bylaw change type of charter amendment, yes, it's right. People either vote yes or a couple vote no, and some abstain. But I think if there's attention drawn to it and the practice of democracy is happening around these questions, then I think you get different outcomes.
Now, at least in Montgomery County, there have been competing questions belatedly, right? So the one reason why there is a higher rate of rejection, perhaps, is that the council has from time to time put up competing questions to those that are brought by citizens. It may be the case this time around as well. How does that play out?
So that law is funky. The way that law works in Maryland is that if there are textually competitive provisions in two charter amendments that both pass, the textually competitive parts of both of them are nullified. So the game the Montgomery County Council has played in the past is to offer one that is very similar to one that has come via petition, and either to nullify it or to, you know, to hope to both pass and you nullify it, or to hope just theirs wins and the other ones lose. In Baltimore City, our Charter Commission this year recommended, in response to the Sinclair Broadcasting sponsored amendment to reduce the council size to 8, we recommended a charter amendment that would have set the council size to 12. We did it fully well knowing that we prefer 14, but that 12 would be better than 8. And if the two of them both passed, they would nullify each other. Now, I think it is bad democratic practice, even if it is good gameplay, to put a competing amendment on the ballot so with the hope that it nullifies another amendment. I think when voters see two things that pass and neither of them happen, they are confused, and to the degree they're paying attention, lose trust in the process.
Why would they have this law if this was such a bad idea?
I think it is to give councils the ability to play good games with charter amendments. And we can talk about whether that's a good idea or not, but the Montgomery County Charter Commission in 2022 recommended that there be something amended to the charter which said, though, if they're competing, the one with the higher number of votes would be the one that would win. And I think Anne Arundel County uses that standard right now. So the idea would be, instead of the council putting an amendment up to nullify a citizen amendment, the council would put up an amendment, and whichever one got more votes was the one that became law.
The petition process in itself is problematic, at least especially in Baltimore, but also, I suppose, anywhere else. And it is sometimes taken hostage by rich folks such as David Smith of Sinclair and now the owner of Baltimore Sun. What examples are there from Baltimore or elsewhere in Maryland that illustrate that problem?
I don't think the term limit proposal that David Smith proposed in 2022 is an example of this, actually. I think that legislative term limits are a problem, but I don't think most voters think legislative term limits are a problem. I think if you ask most voters, 7 in 10 voters probably do agree that legislative term limits are okay. I tend to think that legislative term limits decrease institutional memory, decrease experience, and increase power for lobbyists and special interests, but I don't think voters think that. I do think that some of these property tax type amendments that lower the ability of the city to levy property taxes are very problematic. I think it's a type of question that is difficult to pose to voters directly. If you say to voters, do you want to lower taxes? I think most of the time, most voters are going to say yes to that. And I think having that be one of the powers within charter amendments is probably a policy area we should take a look at. I think another one is the current example that David Smith is proposing right now of this charter amendment that would decrease the size of the city council. He will make suggestions about why the council size needs to be more like Baltimore County or Howard County or Harford County. But I don't think that those are actually apt examples for a dense urban area like Baltimore City, where the council has a constituent service role and a representation role. You know, and so I think that this is an example. If this one passes, I think this is an example of a wealthy person using the power to get something on the ballot easily because of unlimited campaign financing laws and an assumption that everything passes that is probably counterproductive. I think the answer to that is to build a thicker democracy in which we don't take for granted that all of these things pass and that we can have coalitions of electeds, labor organizations, and grassroots organizations that can convince people to vote no on these things. And so I'm part of an organization that's forming right now. I think it's going to be called Baltimore for Democracy. And it is a grassroots organization of people who are going to go out and knock doors, talk to their neighbors, go to community associations in order to defeat this charter amendment that would lower the council size to 8. So, you know, I think that the problem of wealthy people buying charter amendments is overblown, but I think it's real. Most of the charter amendments that happen in Maryland most of the time are put on the ballot by councils, not by individuals, not by grassroots groups, and not by wealthy people. They're put on by councils. And so I think it is a real policy issue, but I don't think there's a ton of examples of it that are uncontested, I guess I would say.
But money does play a role. I mean, petitions are marketed, they are sought, they are professionals who do this. What about that?
That's a huge problem. And RFK Jr. And David Smith have been paying tremendous amounts of money at per petition rates in the state of Maryland this year and around the country. And that sets the market at a higher level. The Green Party, which I'm a member of, oftentimes uses some paid petitioners to complement our volunteers. And I think that is okay. But with unlimited money in politics, where we used to, or in ballot initiatives, where we used to pay $2 a signature, now the market rate is often $5, $6, $7 a signature. And the people who can afford that are people with large amounts of money when you're talking about 10,000 signatures. The Baltimore Baby Bonus did it entirely with volunteers, and I think they raised $4,000. That's the type of thing that a volunteer organization can raise. It can pay for materials, it can pay for websites and things like that. That's an entirely different question than paying $10 a signature for 15,000 signatures so that you can get something on the ballot.
Is it $10?
Some places. I mean, RFK has been paying some people around the country $10 a signature this year.
When petitions are volunteer, do they tend to have a higher signature rejection rate than if they are paid for?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course they do, because paid petitioners are good at doing two things. They're good at being persistent and getting people to sign the thing, and they're good at making sure that the very strict validation standards are met. Volunteers are good about being passionate and committed, but they're not great at following the strict standards. Let me give you an example about this that I know from a petition that is going on right now. An older volunteer went out and did, you know, probably a 20 signature sheets, 100 signatures worth of work. And when they signed the affidavit that said that they had completed those signatures and they had observed them, they accidentally misdated it to 2025 instead of 2024. All 100 of those signatures, all 100 of those voters who legitimately expressed their right to sign that petition had their signature rejected because of the small clerical mistake that the volunteer had made. It was very clear that if these signatures were being turned in June of 2024, that they weren't collected in June of 2025, but there's no ability to correct that. There's no ability to fix that. And that's the type of thing a volunteer is more likely to mess up on than a paid petitioner.
Isn't there technology to fix that? Are apps not allowed to do that?
Yeah. So in 2020, COVID lockdowns meant we couldn't go out and collect petitions. The state of Maryland said that we weren't supposed to be outside in public, much less within 6 feet of other people. So the State Board of Elections allowed us to develop an app which allowed people to fill out petitions online, verify their name and information against the State Board of Elections database, and then save them and print them and turn them in. The Green Party and the Libertarian Party both did that in 2020, and it vastly increased the number of signatures that were valid. And even to the degree that Jared DeMarinis, when he took over the State Board of Elections, told the Baltimore Sun that it was a policy success, and it was a policy success because it was better for voters and better for boards of election to have printed type things instead of handwritten things.
Why are they not used more widely?
So after 2020, after the state of emergency went away, they took away electronic signatures, and they have said that we need to go through the legislature in order to get electronic signatures back. I think there's a couple of reasons, a couple of good faith reasons why they're not used more widely. I think there's security concerns. I think there's validity concerns. And I think that there is a degree to which they want to make sure that somebody's not setting up an algorithm to sign for a bunch of people or something like that.
How are they sure that didn't happen in 2020?
There's a piece of legislation that Delegate Sheila Ruth and Senator Joe Carter sponsored in 2024 that would have allowed the State Board of Elections to develop regulations for how to make this a permanent feature. Now, the State Board of Elections can make this a permanent feature right now because there's also Maryland code that says that agencies can use electronic forms instead of paper forms as they see fit. But the board feels that this is a political question and that the legislature should have a say on it.
The ballot petition modernization bill, as it is called, apart from the electronic signatures, what else was it trying to do?
One of the things that it does is it cleans up the name standard so that a voter who writes their name properly but does not, or legibly and well enough to understand that it is that voter, but does not include a middle initial, for example, that currently gets invalidated.
I don't have a middle initial.
So you'd be okay. My name is Stephen Andrew Ellis. And if I wrote Steve Ellis, that would not be taken. Even if I had my birth date correct, I had my address correct. If I wrote Andy Ellis, that would not be taken. Even if I had my birth date correct and my address correct. And so sometimes voters don't remember, you know, they're out at a farmer's market. They got a dog in one hand, a bag of groceries in another hand. They're willing to sign this thing and they just kind of scribble Andy Ellis and they move on. And, you know, that's where most signatures are gathered at this point. They're out in public. They're at metro stations. They're at fairs, festivals, farmer's markets. And the name standard is that it should match exactly what appears on your voter registration card. And a lot of people don't remember exactly what appears on their voter registration cards. And a lot of signatures get invalidated for this purpose.
I'm thinking that the way to do this is to use, again, a software like the NGP VAN, where the full name is already there. And all you need to do is to pull up your name, do some signature work.
Yeah.
And do some affirmative, questions about, are you saying yes to, A or B or C, and create a list that way.
Totally. And so the way that it worked in, the way that it worked here in 2020 was it allowed independent software like the NGP VAN to do it. The way that it works in Arizona, New Mexico, and the city of Denver is that it is actually tied directly to the state or local boards of elections already existing technology stack. So if you think about the fact that you can go to the Board of Elections right now and request an absentee ballot, change your affiliation, change your registration, that's because there's some identity verification built into their stack already. And so I think the real answer to this is the State Board of Elections should do what the state of Arizona and the state of New Mexico have done and allow people to sign ballot petition signatures via their website, via their technology stack with the identity verification that they're already using.
The bill, however, did not propose that.
It did not propose it, but it does not preclude that.
The Montgomery County Council's letter tries to raise the threshold, not by changing the number, but by asking that there be a percentage. What are the considerations for this threshold argument?
So, first of all, I agree that it should be a percentage instead of a number. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense that getting a charter amendment on the ballot in Montgomery County is the same as getting a charter amendment on the ballot in Wicomico County. And that is the case right now. And I think that the council is right to identify that. Now, the question will be, what is the percentage of? So in that letter, they talk about registered voters, which is the current percentage in the state constitution, and they talk about the number of voters who voted in the last gubernatorial election. Those are two drastically different things. So if we think about Baltimore City, there's 391,500 registered voters or something like that. And there's 147,000 people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. So what we're starting with is a big question about what we do with percentages. The second question is, what is the percentage? So if you set the threshold at 8% for Baltimore City on the first number, 8% of total registered voters in Baltimore City is about 31,000 signatures. That would be a 21,000 signature increase over what we have right now. If you set it at 8% of people who voted for governor in Baltimore City, it'd be 11,700, something like that. So those things make a big difference. What is the percentage and what is the percentage of? But I think we need to understand what is a reasonable amount of signatures to be collected by a mostly volunteer-based organization.
Baltimore City Council and the mayor have opposed the baby bonus ballot question, right? They have sued to keep that ballot question off the ballot in November.
Yep.
So there is this issue of what is thought to be a good policy to be done through petition and what is not a good policy to be done through petition. What is the politics about that?
The baby bonus copied exactly from the Children and Youth Fund language about the funding mechanism. So the Children and Youth Fund was something that was sponsored by Brandon Scott when he was in the council. He is now the mayor, and it created a set aside of money to be used by a commission that would fund children and youth programs. That was passed by the council. It was put onto the ballot by the council passing it, and it passed, and it's running right now, part of Baltimore City government. The baby bonus copied the language that was used for that charter amendment exactly for how they would do the funding mechanism for the baby bonus. And so what I believe the mayor and the council are trying to argue is that that is a sufficient type of program or a council passed charter amendment, but not for a popular passed charter amendment. They're going to go to court on this and we're going to see, but it will put the Children and Youth Fund at risk, I believe, if they go forward and rule that this type of policy is not allowed to be charter amendment material.
The objection is really that this kind of ballot question takes away the legislative power of the city council to make budgets.
That's what they're saying right now. And they will need to prove in court that there is a distinction between a council-based charter amendment and a popular charter amendment or petition-based charter amendment in order to not jeopardize the Children and Youth Fund while trying to stop the baby bonus.
So does this mean that a ballot question on property tax cap would also not be feasible here on after if the court rules on it?
Yes. So I believe that is actually what they're seeking, right? I believe that the baby bonus is a casualty of trying to fight the property tax, charter amendment. The property tax charter amendment would decrease the property tax in Baltimore City pretty significantly. It would blow holes in the budget and it would blow holes in revenue. And I believe that basic income for young people, which has been a leading issue of Brendan Scott's, would be just fine if they weren't also trying to negate the property tax question. So I think that the baby bonus has been caught up in the attempt to shut down the property tax question, and that they're going to try to make a new doctrine which limits the ability of petition-based charter amendments to things that aren't limited by council-based charter amendments.
Well, so property tax caps have been petition materials in several states
and in Maryland.
And so how do you actually get it?
But I think that this is a legal play to get the Maryland Supreme Court to say that if you want to put restrictions on the form and nature of charter amendments, you have to pass a constitutional amendment to do that.
So there is a bill that is going to perhaps in the works again with the ballot petition modernization 2.0.
It's my expectation that it is coming next session. One of the things that we've understood while lobbying for this bill for the last couple of years is that there's not an appetite to have these discussions about making it easier to get things on the ballot by using electronic signatures or decreasing the number that get invalidated until the threshold rises. So I think that the Montgomery County effort is in the right spirit, right? Like, I do believe it should be a percentage instead of a fixed number. And I think it will open the door for some conversations about how the process needs to be modernized and transformed.
Is Maryland more ballot question happy than other states? I mean, California, obviously.
We don't have initiative at the statewide level. And so the Western states have initiative at the statewide level. The only thing we can do is referendum. We can call into question a bill of the General Assembly that doesn't have appropriations in it, basically. And that's what happened with same-sex marriage a decade ago. At the local level, the jurisdictions with the charter that has more pages in it have more charter amendments on the ballot. Montgomery County has 18 pages in their charter. Baltimore City has 280. So Montgomery County has a really cleaned up charter that really dictates form and nature of government. So you don't see as many charter amendments in Montgomery County, whereas in Baltimore City, it has been used as ancillary to legislating. And all sorts of ridiculous stuff is in the Baltimore City Charter. So if you want to change some of that stuff, you have to have charter amendments. I think anytime it looks like if you get something on the ballot, it will pass, it becomes attractive to people who don't have access to get the elected leaders to do that thing. What makes it attractive to David Smith? He can spend $1 million and change the composition of the city council and feel pretty confident that it's going to pass. If that thing has a 99% passage rate, if it gets on the ballot, that's an attractive way to do government for somebody who doesn't have access to elected officials.
But is it the democratic way to do a government?
That's a good question. The best example of citizen-based charter amendments, I look at the baby bonus or the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. And in both of these cases, they were progressive, left-wing of the Democratic Party type of groups that went to the elected officials and asked them to do something that they thought was good. Elected officials ignored them. Elected officials said no, but they thought that there was popular support for these things. And I think in places like Baltimore City, Montgomery County, or some of your red counties on the shore, it is helpful to be able to have another means of accessing the government.
Andy Ellis, thank you.
Thank you, Sunil. It's been great.
That's Andy Ellis, the Green Party's presumed gubernatorial candidate for 2026 and member of the City of Baltimore's Charter Commission, as well as a close follower of Ballot Questions, Maryland's referendum system. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analyses. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Alexandria, Virginia alt-rock band Jackie and the Treehorns, Steve Rubin and Pam Long on vocals, guitars, and piano, Frank Caputo on bass and synth, and Brian Gibson on drums. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihbpod.org. I hope you will subscribe, share, and rate the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time. Nothing more to lose. I might be too much for you to explain. My own persistence has immortal remains.